Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Today, undersleeping and the damage that it's doing more than you think. If you woke up without your alarm clock today, feeling rested and refreshed, you're probably unique among your friends and colleagues. And if you got less than 7 hours of sleep last night, you're in distressingly good company. I say distressingly because this hour you're going to hear all of the ways that undersleeping can rob you of your vitality, your good health, most importantly, sharp cognition, even years of your life. As our guests join us today, I want to hear from the sleepless and the rested among us. And I want you to think about this. Are you one of those people who proudly proclaims that 6 hours of sleep is enough for you, you don't really need any more, that you secretly regard people who need more sleep and get more as lazy and less ambitious? Yeah, we have some attitudes here in this country about people who get more sleep. Think about it. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Dr. Yoel Ju is a neurologist and sleep researcher at Washington University, and she's with us today from St. Louis. And Dr. Ju, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Dr. Matthew Walker is with us. He's a neuroscientist and director of UC Berkeley's Center for Human Sleep Science. And his new book is titled Why We Sleep. And he's with us from Berkeley. And Dr. Walker, I'm going to ask if we can use first names, if that's all right with everybody. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
And Matthew, I'm zeroing in on the stigma of sleep because I realized as I thought about this that I've even bought in at times to this idea that sleeping is for sissies, even though I know that I'm at my best with 8 hours of sleep a night, and I try to do that every night. How do we become a culture that scoffs at sleep?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I think sleep has an image problem in the modern day. You know, we label people who get sufficient sleep as lazy, as slothful. And what's interesting, by the way, about that is we don't always have that opinion. You know, none of us would look at an infant during the day sleeping and say, well, what a lazy baby. You know, We don't say that because we know that sleep at that time of life is non-negotiable. It's absolutely necessary. But somewhere between infancy and now, if you look at the surveys, even childhood, not only do we abandon the notion that sleep is essential and a biological edict that we all must follow, sleep is actually something to be chastised. And people should walk around, you know, with this badge of honor of sleeplessness. So it's a very strange, I think, mindset. And how do we change that? It's not going to be easy, but we've changed our views around, for example, smoking. So I think we can change our views around sleep. It needs to happen at the government level. We need public health campaigns. I don't remember the last time I saw any first world nation have a public health campaign regarding the importance of sleep.
Yeah, good point.
It has to happen at the educational level. You know, when I was at school, I had lectures on the dangers of, you know, alcohol, drugs, risky behavior. No one gave me a lesson regarding the importance of sleep. So it has to happen in the classroom. It also has to happen in families. You know, there is a parent-to-child transmission of sleep neglect. We rip covers off our teenagers at the weekends, and we proclaim that they're wasting the day. So there is that stigma that's transmitted there, and those children will go on to do the same behavior to their children in, you know, 20, 30 years' time. So it has to be a sweeping change at all levels. There is no one magic bullet, in my view.
Yeah, let me take some calls here because we've got people that want to talk about this. To Steve in St. Paul. Steve, your story is pretty interesting. You're a firefighter, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So how do you think about the way you could sleep when you first got into the business of firefighting and what happens now?
Well, I think the biggest thing is I really use it as kind of like a badge of honor. Like we would be up all night. I'd be able to go home. Everything was fine. And now that I've been doing this for about 15 years, just even when I'm not at the job, when I'm at home and I should be able to sleep, I'm unable to. And it's just deeply, deeply frustrating.
Yoel, how is it that we've turned into, as Steve says, you know, in your youth, you feel like you're indomitable and you can live on 5 hours of sleep, and it becomes very frustrating when, as you age, you realize that you do need more sleep. And maybe you needed more sleep as a kid, but you were more resilient around it. How'd that become us?
Well, I do think that as people age and turn to middle age, it becomes harder to do shift work and to chronically deprive oneself of sleep. I hear very commonly from my patients who are shift workers, especially, that when they first started out, when they were young, they were able to do these night shifts and, you know, would be able to drive home safely afterwards and be able to be very productive. But as they age, they just lost that resilience and had more difficulty being alert overnight at work and also on their home commute. So there is an age effect where it becomes more difficult to sustain shift work as well as inadequate sleep.
Yoel, what's happening in the brain as we age? I think there's a perception that as you get older, it gets harder and harder to get that deep, restful sleep. Is that true? Does the science back that up?
So as people age, if you look at studies of large populations, there is a decrease in the amount of what we call slow wave sleep. That's sort of the deep restful sleep. However, it's not necessarily that happens in everyone. I do think that there are sleep problems that interfere in quite a large proportion of the population as they age. So I do think it's certainly true that sleep does change and perhaps becomes less deep as people age, but that doesn't mean that people shouldn't be able to have restful, adequate sleep.
Joshua says on Twitter, I get called out by people for actually getting 7.5 hours a night and being in bed by 10 and asleep by 11 every night. To John in Fridley here. Hi, John. How's this work in your own life?
Well, it kind of stinks. I graduated high school at 19. I went in the Marine Corps, where it's kind of needed or it's warranted that you only get about 3 to 4 hours a night. And then went into college where I wanted a social life, but I needed to keep up with schoolwork. So that didn't stop. And now I work 50 to 60 hours a week. And, well, I still want to keep a social life, so I don't get a whole lot of sleep.
So, John, what would you say on an average night that you're running on? 6 hours, less than that?
Yeah, usually around 3. If I can get a solid 3 hours, I can.
Oh my gosh, Matthew, what's going on in John's brain, trying to live on 3 hours of sleep a night?
Well, firstly, I sympathize with John. I think there is a modern day pressure, and all of the reasons that John describes are many of the reasons that I hear for people undersleeping. I would note, however, several things. All of the major diseases that are killing us in the developed world now have significant and many of them causal links to a lack of sleep. So if your goal is to have a life that is free of disease for as long as possible, then increasing sleep amount in this example is going to be essential. We also know from large-scale epidemiological studies a very simple truth. The shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. Short sleep predicts all-cause mortality. So I would simply note that the old maxim that you can sleep when you're dead is actually mortally unwise advice. We know from those scientific studies that if you adopt that mindset, your life will be shorter, and the quality of that now shorter life will be significantly worse.
Matthew, what happens in the brain in 8 hours of sleep or 7.5 hours of sleep that can't happen in 4 or 6 hours of sleep?
Well, what you miss out on is a critical set of sleep stages if you are what we call top and tailing your sleep, if you're shaving off sleep at the front end and shaving off sleep at the back end. Losing sleep in the first half of the night means that you will lose out on deep non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is that sort of deep restorative sleep. And then waking up too early means that you will shortchange your brain of a critical stage of sleep called rapid eye movement sleep or dream sleep. And all stages of sleep, we now understand, are essential and necessary for all of the different brain and body health benefits that sleep provides. So if we could have done away with an hour of sleep or any one of these stages of sleep, trust me, Mother Nature would have excised that millions of years ago. But it's taken Mother Nature 3.6 million years to put this essential need for 8 hours of sleep in place for us human beings. So no wonder when we shortchange anything less than 8 hours, we see sickness, disease, and ill health come into the equation.
Yoel, I know you do a lot of research on dementia, Alzheimer's, cognition, and sleep. And I'm hoping that you can explain what the brain is doing with this idea of, I think Matthew calls it neurological sanitation, what the brain is doing in that deep sleep that is necessary if you want to not be at risk for Alzheimer's. I know I've put that too firmly, but how would you explain it?
Well, there are probably a couple things going on during a deep restorative sleep that help kind of clear out the brain and prepare it for the next day. A few years ago, a system called the glymphatic system was described. It's kind of like a washing machine for your brain where all the waste products around the brain cells get cleared out. And that system functions maximally during deep non-REM sleep. Also, it's noted that when you're sleeping, your brain cells are resting, and so they release less of the toxic waste products into the space surrounding them. So for both those reasons, if there is less sleep or worse quality sleep, there will be more of the toxic products just sitting around. And one of those products is something called beta amyloid or amyloid.
Mm-hmm.
And if levels of those are elevated for chronic periods of time, then that soluble substance becomes insoluble, meaning it can't dissolve, and it clumps up into something called amyloid plaques.
Okay.
And that is the first step of Alzheimer's disease, and it is toxic to surrounding brain cells. And so the current thinking is that poor sleep over a long period of time will increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease.
So this the connection here, Matthew, is between the buildup of these proteins in the brain and undersleeping, not giving the brain enough time to clean things out. I know that's real layman's language there, but is that basically it?
Yeah, it really is in the case of, you know, good night, sleep clean, that there is this sewage system in the brain that when we go into deep sleep, the brain gets bathed with a solution that we call cerebrospinal fluid, and that washes away these toxic metabolic detritus products that build up as we're awake. So we can think of wakefulness as low-level brain damage based on the toxic buildup, and then sleep washes away that metabolic buildup. And it cleanses the brain of these factors that promote Alzheimer's disease. We also know, by the way, unfortunately, it's a vicious cycle that when that toxic sticky protein related to Alzheimer's, beta amyloid, builds up in the brain, it builds up in the very regions that are generating the deep sleep that you need to wash it away.
Uh-huh.
So unfortunately, the more of it that builds up, the less deep sleep that you have, the more toxic Alzheimer's protein builds up, so on and so forth. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy leading to this escalation that we know is prototypical of Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Matthew Walker is with us this morning. He's a neuroscientist and director of UC Berkeley's Center for Human Sleep Science and the author of a new book called Why We Sleep. And Dr. Yoel Ju is a neurologist and sleep researcher at Washington University, and she works on this area of sleep research that I really wanted to dig into, and that's the connection between undersleeping, dementia, Alzheimer's, and what is actually going on in the brain when you're sleeping deeply and why you need enough deep sleep. So my question to you is, are you one of those people who walk around thinking, if I get 5 hours of deep sleep a night, I'm good to go? What are you thinking as you hear this science? What prevents you from getting that kind of very restorative deep sleep. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Get a busy signal, call us back. And you can also tweet me your question at @CarrieNPR, where a listener says, I'm 45 now, once could work overnight shifts in my 20s, no longer tolerate that. Takes days to recover from that now. Yeah, I've experienced that too. They add, I added blackout shades and get 8 every night now. It was a magical improvement to me, daytime mental health that I didn't ever know I needed. To the phones here to Al in Eden Prairie. Hi, Al, how are you?
Doing pretty good, pretty good.
Good.
Actually, I heard the doctor on the Fresh Air about a month or so ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I took it to heart. I tried. I thought it was scary, all the things he was mentioning. So I got rid of caffeine. I'm 55. I got rid of caffeine. I tried to go to bed around 10 to 11. For the last 4 or 5 years, I'm getting 4 to 5 hours. If I'm really exhausted, dog tired, I'll get 6 in a night. Didn't make a bit of difference. I hear everything that he mentions is, you know, they both mention is possibly going to happen. Scary. And, you know, the question is, well, do you need to start taking drugs? Are there certain things to do to get real sleep? I assume drug sleep isn't the same as real sleep.
Okay, so
is it possible that it only affects certain people who are predisposed to this, or is pretty much everyone who has short sleep going to end up with Alzheimer's?
I hear like 4 questions in there, Al. So, Yoel, will you tackle the, if you take some kind of a sleeping aid, do you get that kind of restorative deep sleep that we're talking about?
Well, I guess I would back up a little bit and say that most people who are having trouble sleeping or feeling restored after adequate sleep time probably have a sleep problem that is just being masked by any medication being taken for sleep. I think that the vast majority of people who have insomnia or difficulty sleeping, they either have a sleep disorder or a medical disorder or something is going on where they are unable to either fall asleep or their sleep quality is poor. I do think that there are a small number of people who have true, just plain insomnia by itself, but that is actually pretty rare. So I would say before taking any drugs to try to improve sleep, there should be a pretty good search for a cause of the difficulty sleeping.
I also think, Matthew, that Al was asking about whether you're genetically predisposed towards bad sleep. Do you find that?
No, we don't necessarily in terms of if someone has been a good sleeper in the past and then becomes a bad sleeper, that tends to be factors that may be associated with a sleep disorder or aging. We do know, however, that insomnia does have a genetic component to it. There seems to be about 30 to 40% of insomnia has heritability to it. So if your parents are both suffering from insomnia, there is a contribution that can happen that seems to be genetic. But if you start off being a good sleeper and then transition to being a bad sleeper, it's more likely that it's an underlying cause, perhaps a sleep disorder or something else that's at play here. So I would advise perhaps going to your doctor and seeing if you can get a referral to a sleep clinic to see if we can get this sorted out.
What actually happens at a sleep clinic, Matthew?
So people will come in and you will tend to meet with a board certified sleep medicine doctor. They will do an interview with you. They will try to pin down what are the most likely candidate potential sleep disorders that you're suffering. They'll also try to rule out other factors that are masquerading as a sleep disorder. And if it looks like perhaps you have those primary conditions that are not a sleep problem, they will advise that you get those treated first and maybe they will resolve your sleep problem. So it was never a sleep problem in itself. It was another sort of condition or problem that was producing bad sleep. So they will go through that. And then if they feel as though a sleep recording session and a sleep clinic session is necessary, they will bring you in or they will wire you up and send you home with a device both of those are options.
Lori says, I love to sleep. After my son was born 6 years ago, I learned to appreciate, understand deprivation and benefits of quality sleep. And Andre says, I love sleep, but as a night owl in an early bird world, it's hard to always get the amount I need. Call here from Sarah in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was just calling because I'm so passionate about this, and I'm so glad you're talking about it.
Good.
I'm a mental health therapist, and I truly believe that many people would have great relief of their depression and anxiety symptoms if they would address their sleep. And as the doctors are saying, I mean, there's lots of reasons, and it just comes down to what works. And it doesn't work to sleep 5 hours a night. I lied to myself for years that it worked. And sure, I functioned, but not well.
And Sarah, were you aware that as you were, you said you lied to yourself, were you thinking, hey, I can do this. I can supplement with caffeine. My mental
Absolutely.
Sharpness is as good as it as it's always been.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All the lies that we tell ourselves, and probably that I was superior. I was part of the lie, too. And then working in these office with people that are having a lot of these symptoms, and it's just like the caller from Eden Prairie and, you know, the social life and the work and you know, the kids and all of these things. I agree. It makes it hard, but it doesn't work to not sleep.
So, Yoel, can you speak to the connection between sleeping and good mental health and some of what she was talking about with seeing people with bipolar disease or mental health conditions? What do you know about that?
Sure. So for both mood disorders such as bipolar or depression, as well as anxiety, having difficulty sleeping can be a prominent and early symptom. On the other hand, having poor sleep tends to kind of make things worse for people with depression or bipolar or anxiety. Having poor sleep seems to kind of drive the problems, especially, for example, at the beginning of a depressive phase. You know, some people who have recurrent episodes of depression or bipolar are actually very attuned to their sleep, and they notice if their sleep patterns are changing, because that is an early warning that perhaps another episode is coming.
I see.
And so that can be a good warning time to seek additional help, to try to kind of nip things in the bud and try to address the sleep problems before it kind of feeds back into worse psychiatric problems.
This is a follow-up call on that, I think, from Terry in Zimbrota. Terry, what are you specifically interested in?
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Well, I got a couple of things. First of all, I'm the mother of a bipolar son. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed about a year and a half ago. And so that's, you know, caused us to get very acutely aware of the importance of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I'm concerned with is that, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's seems to be a family thing, coming from my mother's side.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if there's any connection between those two, the bipolar or other mental disorders that are affected by sleep and the onset of Alzheimer's. The second part of what I wanted to ask, and then I will hang up and let you folks talk, is what are anybody's thoughts on like childhood or early life trauma that would affect sleep cycles as an adult?
Okay. I think we've got it, Terry. Maybe, Yoel, you will follow up on what she was asking about the connection between bipolar and sleep and Alzheimer's.
Sure. I actually am not aware of studies that have specifically looked at any association between bipolar disorder and Alzheimer's disease. Perhaps Dr. Walker can comment.
Matthew, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of them either. I think, you know, we've only just started to uncover this relationship between insufficient sleep being a significant risk factor for the development of Alzheimer's disease. So I think it's probably just too early yet for those studies to have yet emerged. We do know, however, I want to come back to the mental health story. In my own laboratory over the past 20 or so years, we have not been able to discover a single psychiatric condition in which sleep is normal.
Wow.
So I think sleep has a profound story to tell in both our understanding, perhaps our treatment, and maybe even ultimately our prevention of several grave mental health illnesses. So I think we're starting to learn that sleep is a form of overnight therapy in some ways for our emotional lives. It's emotional first aid. And as soon as sleep becomes deficient, we start to see aspects of emotional health and mood and mental health deteriorate quite significantly. So there's a very strong connection between those two.
Yeah, well, I think this is interesting. Lucy called from Duluth and she said, why do we tolerate so little sleep in our physicians? They're very proud of their 36-hour rotations. Yes, our medical professionals in training are denied sleep constantly. Why?
Well, I would first say there are actually a lot of efforts to try to reduce sleep deprivation and worsening in job functioning related to sleep deprivation among medical trainees. So I hope that, you know, the trainees who are now coming up will have it better than I did.
Because you went through that, Yoel?
Yeah. So, I mean, during residency, we would take overnight call, and our shifts were actually limited to 30 hours, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But still, you know, functioning at that level
ridiculous.
Is pretty hard.
30 hours. I mean,
and to do that every third night is pretty hard.
I know. Yoel, think about this. If you had been called in, I'm sure this happened, hour 25, right? You're called in and you have to make a serious decision about something medical. Your mind, I can't imagine what it had to go through to bring the cognitive sharpness that you needed to make a good decision.
Right. And I mean, I do think that the medical field kind of self-selects for people who are able to be a little bit more resilient to sleep deprivation and long shifts. That being said, I do think that there is value in learning how to function overnight and take care of patients, because people don't just get sick between 9 and 5, unfortunately. You know, people get sick 24 hours a day. And so I do think physicians need to learn to be able to do that. You know, there's also a value in taking care of one patient for a long period of time instead of having to hand off care. And so there's a lot of effort going on right now in terms of researching what is the optimal balance between handoffs between doctors and making sure people are sufficiently rested to take good care of patients.
That's interesting. Matthew, you were talking about a public health campaign a little earlier. What do you say to your colleagues in the medical profession?
Well, I think it's quite disgraceful that UL has had to be placed under those conditions. And we know that it's imposed on all of our residents. And by the way, the data is very clear regarding 30-hour shifts. We know that residents who've worked a 30-hour shift relative to those who've worked 16 hours will make 460% more diagnostic mistakes in the intensive care units. We know that one in every 20 medical residents will kill a patient due to a fatigue-related error.
Wow.
We also know that residents who've pulled a 30-hour shift, let's say that they've been working in the emergency room, when they themselves get back into their car to drive home after that shift, they are 168% more likely to get into a car accident themselves and be back in the emergency room, but now as a patient rather than the attending resident.
Wow.
So I think that we need a seismic change, and I think, you know, some of this perhaps is an old school mentality. It may be the idea that my mind's made up, don't confuse me with the facts. And it's the same in many workplaces, so we desperately need a change there. And you can appeal on the basis not of humanity, empathy, and diagnostic mistakes. You can simply appeal on the basis of dollar value. You could save millions in malpractice suits as a consequence, by way of allowing our residents to get sufficient sleep. So it makes dollars and pennies sense. You don't have to think about it from a humanitarian perspective if you wish not to.
Heidi says on Twitter, I've finally come to understand different people need different amounts of sleep. I need 7 hours. My husband needs 10. And to the phones here to Ryan in Minneapolis, another firefighter, Ryan. Glad you called in. What's your story?
Yeah, thanks. Good morning.
Sure.
I just am getting off shift, and my wife called me and said, you've got to turn on NPR and call them.
Good.
But I feel like I could almost do probably a whole hour show on my sleep and everything I've been through. One thing I wanted to just mention real quick was I actually did a sleep study, and it was a horrible experience. And
why?
Slept terribly. Well, they paste all these things all over your face and head and glue this stuff to you, and then and then expect you to sleep. And I swear I had a terrible night's sleep. And they told me the next day, they're like, "Well, you slept for almost 8 hours." And I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." There's no, and I was exhausted the next day. So then their only suggestion when I met with the doctor was, "Well, we'll put you on uppers during the day and downers at night."
Oh.
And I was like, "Dad, you got to be joking. There's no way I'm doing that." But my main question that I really was curious about is I have these absolutely crazy dreams. And it happens, I don't know, probably, I could probably say 10 nights a month where, I mean, I'll sweat through 2 t-shirts a night and I'll wake up almost feeling ill, you know, like I did not sleep at all. And that's even if I've slept, you know, majority of the night.
All right.
And I'm just curious if they have any, done any studies on that or know anything about those type of dreams or anything you can do.
Yoel, to you first on our firefighter's question about sleeping 8 hours, doing that sleep study, and waking up feeling exhausted. And it sounds like he experiences that fairly often. What's happening there, do you think?
Well, first of all, I would say that sleeping poorly in the sleep lab or during a sleep study is actually very common. I tell people it's not going to be their best night of sleep. And surprisingly, we're actually not focusing too much on the actual quality of sleep people get because we realize it's going to be very different from home. The purpose of a sleep study is to look for any underlying sleep disorders, particularly obstructive sleep apnea, which is a breathing problem during sleep. It is very, very, very common. And so that is often a first step in kind of assessing for what might be leading to poor quality sleep. Also, I think that caller had said he was a firefighter, so I'm assuming he does shift work.
Right. He was just getting off, I think, when he called in.
Right. And unfortunately, during shift work, what's happening is people are trying to sleep during a time that doesn't match with what their internal clock or circadian system is telling them to do. The sleep system and the circadian system are actually two completely separate systems in our brain. And the circadian system sets the window for the best sleep. So if someone sleeps during that window set by the circadian system, that sleep will be the best sleep that they can have. If they sleep outside of that window, for example, if we have jet lag or if we're doing shift work, then that sleep is going to be very light, restless, perhaps have disturbing dreams or waking up during dreams. And so I would think perhaps it is his shift work that's contributing to his non-restorative sleep.
Crazy dreams, Matthew. What does that raise in your mind when you hear the way he describes the kind of vivid dreams he's having?
Well, firstly, lots of people will report having dreams, and many people have very intense, vivid dreams. But what was interesting about, I think, the caller's story there is that it doesn't always happen. It's somewhat infrequent, maybe 10 days a month, I think, was the mention.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we often see that can instigate more intense dreams is actually the lack of sufficient REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, which is the stage from which you dream. So if you selectively deprive someone of rapid eye movement sleep, or they're working, let's say, a night shift where their sleep is disrupted and their work is actually selectively depriving them of that dream sleep, when they finally get the chance to get that recovery sleep, the brain desperately tries to make up that which it has lost before, and it has much more intense and longer amounts of rapid eye movement sleep, which is usually associated with significantly more intense dreaming as a consequence. So it's hard to tell with one individual over the phone, but that could be one of the causes that there is what we call a REM sleep rebound effect, where the brain is trying to sleep back that which it has lost, and in more intense ways.
And Matthew, I think I've read in the book that you really can't make up sleep. You know, we're hearing from some people who say, well, I don't sleep much during the week, and on the weekend, I quote unquote catch up. I hear by your reaction, you really can't do that.
No, you can't. So if I were to take you and deprive you of an entire night of sleep, so you lose 8 hours of sleep, and then I give you all of the recovery sleep that you want on a second or a third or a fourth night, you will sleep more, but you will never sleep back that full 8 hours that you lost. So in other words, sleep is not like the bank. You cannot accumulate a debt during the week and then hope to pay it off at the weekend. And you could ask, for example, why don't we have a credit system for sleep? You know, wouldn't that be wonderful if our brain cells, or we had a version of a brain cell where you could store up that sleep? Because there is precedent in biology for this. It's called the fat cell, because there is another credit system like this, which is during evolution, we had times when we had feast and we had times when there was famine. And we developed a system to combat this called the fat cell, so we could store calories. Now, it's doing us a disservice in the modern era, but let's set that aside. Why isn't there something like that for sleep? And the answer is this. Human beings are the only species that deliberately deprive themselves of sleep for no good reason. In other words, Mother Nature has never had to face the challenge of sleep deprivation throughout the course of evolution. So Mother Nature has never had to come up with a safety net, a solution mechanism for storing up sleep credit. And that's why we suffer such demonstrable ill health when we don't get enough sleep, because there is no safety net in place.
You know, Yoel, what I notice, and this is really frustrating, if I get a poor night's sleep, I find that my brain doesn't work fluidly. That's how I think of it. So I do a show like this every day, and I find that if I've slept poorly, I can't pull, my brain just doesn't seem to be oiled. I can't pull questions out. I have a hard time focusing. Why? I mean, I should be able to, you know, one night where I might get 5 or 6 hours of sleep, why does that wreck my cognition like that? When most nights I'm getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep.
Well, I think that speaks to the importance of what's actually going on during sleep. For example, during deep or slow wave sleep, there's kind of a pruning or downscaling of the new brain cell connections that were made, so that things start over on a clean slate the next day. Mm-hmm. If someone isn't getting a full night's sleep and they're not getting adequate restorative sleep, they're not starting with a clean slate. They're starting with a dirty slate. So they kind of can't think clearly or function optimally the way that they would like.
I mean, what you've described there, when I think of this as fluidly, that kind of makes sense. When you describe that things are clogged up, right?
Right.
In a way that they're not. It's not going to make me feel any better, but now I know why. Question here from Mary in Minneapolis. Hi, Mary. You have a question about Alzheimer's. Is that right?
Yes, I do. Very quick question. I am a 6 hour night sleeper. I fall asleep instantly. I might get up once to use a
Mary, I think we lost the line. So she was talking about 6 hours of sleep a night, Yoel, no alarm, but she has Alzheimer's in her family. What should she be concerned about?
So it is actually a very, very rare for someone to truly be a 6 hour a night sleeper. However, if someone is able to fall asleep, stay asleep, and they wake up without an alarm and they're completely refreshed and they're functioning optimally during the day, I would say, well, perhaps they are one of those very rare people. The studies linking Alzheimer's with poor sleep during midlife have really been in the past few years. And so I don't think that we have had the opportunity to study natural short and long sleepers. I think that those studies are coming. But I would say, you know, unless someone truly is one of those rare, very short sleepers, that if I had a history of Alzheimer's disease in my family, I would do everything possible to, you know, get 7.5, 8 hours in bed every night.
Joseph says, Matthew, to follow up on that, my wife averages 5 hours a night. I can't operate like that, but she does fine. Is she really doing fine? Do you believe that people are at, you know, can be at their best and function well on a consistent 5 hours of sleep a night?
Well, we know from the scientific studies now that the number of people who can survive on 5 hours of sleep or less and show no cognitive impairment or bodily impairment, rounded to a whole number and expressed as a percent of the population, is zero. So I'm not meaning to be trite, but it's very unlikely that that is the case. And one of the reasons that people have that opinion, that idea that I can survive just fine on 5 hours of sleep, is that your subjective sense of how well you're doing when you don't have enough sleep is a miserable predictor of objectively how you're doing with insufficient sleep.
Okay, let me put it this way. Are you saying that your view of how well you're doing is distorted because you haven't gotten enough sleep? Is that right?
Yeah, it's a little bit like a drunk driver at a bar. You know, they've had 6 or 7 shots. They pick up their car keys and they say, I'm fine to drive home. And your response is, no, I know that subjectively you think you're fine to drive, but trust me, objectively you are not. You are impaired. And it's the same way that we've learned with sleep deprivation, that you don't know you're sleep deprived when you are sleep deprived. It's an unfortunate irony.
Hear it from a lot of parents of young kids. So let me grab Andrea in New Ulm. Hi, Andrea. Thanks for waiting. What are you thinking about here?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I am a full-time working professional mom. My husband also has a full-time professional job. We have a 6, 4, and 1-year-old.
Oh, boy.
And I was curious what the expert could offer in terms of advice or recommendations in trying to deal with the sleep deprivation that comes with raising a small family, getting up with, you know, teething toddlers and things like that while still maintaining a job and encouraging good sleep habits in our young kids so that we too as parents don't have to be operating on such sleep deprivation. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, Matthew, and also think about a question here from Casey who wants to know, is it better to get up every night or is it better to trade off with your partner and let them do it every other night so you get uninterrupted sleep? What would you say?
I think it's a desperately difficult situation, and many parents go through this. If parents can take the opportunity to nap, for example, I know it's hard if you're a working parent too during the week, but during the weekends, that can sometimes help when the child is napping as well to try and see if you can get back a little bit of that sleep. And then I think split shifts, many parents will find that useful. It really is about just finding what's optimal for the two of you, though. Some people prefer to do it, you know, I'll take the next 3 nights and you take the next 3 nights so that they at least pack in, you know, 3 consistently good nights of sleep. So I think it's a little bit more idiosyncratic, but it's a non-trivial issue.
Yoel, do you have kids? Have you dealt with this?
Yes, and actually this is very salient to me because today is my first day back from maternity leave. I have a 12-week-old.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank
wow.
you. I also have a 3-year-old. So in response to the question about how to try to optimize functioning as a family with young children, I would say, first of all, you need to prioritize the family sleep, not just the adults. There is an epidemic of underslept children that really affects their school functioning and their development. And so trying to improve sleep should be focused on the entire family unit. I think in general, the problem is with kids is of perhaps later bedtimes than they should be having, particularly given how early school starts. And so an earlier bedtime should at least be tried for a few nights to see if that helps things. And then in terms of, you know, how you're going to trade off nights as working parents, I think trying to lengthen the periods of uninterrupted sleep really help. So, for example, if the mother is more of a night owl and the father is a bit of an early bird, then perhaps having the mother take the first half of the night and the father take the second half of the night, that is one possible solution. But it is really tough. You know, my husband and I both work full time, so it is very hard. And to me, the only sort of reassuring thing is that, unlike all of the other demands we have placed on our sleep, sleep deprivation due to children is something that we have evolved through. So something that we are able to sustain and be resilient against, I hope. And so, you know, this too shall pass. And, you know, all we can do is do the best we can.
Yoel, congratulations and welcome back. And I feel like
Thank
I
got
to let you get to work. So really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for the insight and the advice on this. Really good
Thank
to have you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Adam says on Twitter here, Matthew, I have no regular sleep pattern. I'm a locomotive engineer on call almost 24/7. Most weeks I only get 4 to 5 hours per day average. More often than not, I go 24 to 36 hours without sleep. Wow. And a question here for you, Matthew, about sleep disorders from Emma. Hi, Emma. What do you want to know?
Hi. I was just wondering, in all the talk about poor sleep, people like myself who are diagnosed with sleep disorders that are non-treatable, things like narcolepsy, where you sleep a lot but you don't get any good deep sleep, have there been studies about how that might affect Alzheimer's and what can we hope for in terms of maybe either finally finding a solution for some of those sleep disorders or avoiding issues down the line with Alzheimer's?
What do you think, Matthew?
So I think people are working very hard towards alternative therapies for narcolepsy. It's a desperately difficult disorder. It's a disorder where the wake-promoting chemical in the brain becomes deficient. That chemical is called orexin. So people are actually effectively trying to find ways to architect new versions of that chemical that could be taken to see if you could promote and stabilize wakefulness during the day so you don't have excessive sleep bouts and therefore regulate sleep at night. So I don't think the medications that we have right now are ideal for narcolepsy, but I do know there are fantastic people, lots of people, for example, down at Stanford, who are desperately working on this problem and trying to find new drug solutions.
Matthew, you say in the book that you give yourself an 8-hour sleep opportunity every night. I do that too. So that means that you're laying down, you're what, in a dark, cool room, and even if you don't get the full 8 hours, you're giving yourself the opportunity, yes?
That's right. Yeah, I think so. There are several things I do to try and get good sleep. And I don't mean to sound sort of hokey by saying that. If you knew the evidence as I do, and hopefully that people would do after reading the book, you really would choose not to do anything else. You know, I don't want Alzheimer's disease. I don't want cancer. My family has a history of cardiovascular disease. And sleep is probably one of the best forms of blood pressure medication you could ever wish for. So I sleep for completely selfish reasons, in truth, because I want to live longer and live a longer, healthier life. So regularity, going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, a cool room, a dark room, and try to stay away from alcohol and caffeine. Those would be my best tips.
This was really interesting, Matthew. Thank you so much. Good to have you on the show.
You're very welcome. Sleep well. Thanks a lot.
And you, Matthew Walker, with us from UC Berkeley. And the title of the book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams.